So, all the Buddha's teachings fell under the rubric of, he said, achieving lasting peace of mind and reducing stress. That's where they all flow. He didn't teach how to become popular, make friends, achieve success in the world, monetary or material. So this path, the spiritual path, is not going to make us any, necessarily, probably won't make any more money, won't make you have more friends on Facebook or anything like that. Maybe it will, I don't know, but what is that? What it will offer is a path to finding peace of mind, little serenity. And that's good, because actually there's the chances of us attaining really limitless, profound, lasting peace of mind is far greater than achieving unimpinged upon, satisfying, unending wealth, or material goods, or fame. Why? Almost like an insect type sound. And yet I think I know what I was talking about. There are other people competing for all those things. There's other people besides us, if we want money, that are wanting money or wanting careers or wanting fame or wanting unending popularity. And plus, there's something called the hedonic treadmill, that even if you do get it, a lot of money or power or a sense of a wonderful career, we become bored with it, habituated. It's not enough. Because all that stuff is external. It doesn't fill this inner feeling of stress, anxiety, purposelessness, hollowness, loneliness. Despair, whatever it is. So we're after something that addresses this inner state. And the Buddha, when he talked about it, to the Kalamas, he said that you don't have to believe or buy books, self-help books. You don't have to memorize a lot of logic or follow arcane reasoning or take anybody's word for how to do it. The beauty of searching for inner happiness is that we all have to find it ourselves. The Buddha didn't give a list of to-dos to find happiness so much as he gave people tools so that they themselves, in their own lives, could use the tools to find what works for them. So this is not like somebody's going to hand you anything. Nobody's going to reach into your mind or give you a list of things that is going to suddenly make everything all rosy. That's for us ourselves, each one of us, to do. The good news, though, is that a lot of the work in terms of discovering the tools we'll need to get this process underway have been, over the last 2,500 years, pretty well honed. So if you want to start from scratch, you can. Nobody's saying that we have to use any of these tools. The Buddha said the key is simply watching and seeing what the long-term results of our actions are. If you want to start from just there, that's fine. But I'm going to offer some tools tonight that will hopefully speed up the process and give you a set of tools so that no matter what you're going through in life, you can employ these five tools to make the process of discovering what works for you and what doesn't a lot faster, a lot more economical, a lot clearer. The good news is, if we simply have to carry around a whole list in our head or a whole bunch of ideas and if panna or wisdom was just a whole bunch of concepts, the problem is that when you accumulate a lot of concepts, they sound great, but they tend to become conflicting. The mind can use them and twist them and create a whole mess of confusion. For example, a lot of people follow the spiritual axiom, to thine own self be true. Follow your heart. And that's wonderful. But then on the other hand, they're also told the highest achievement in life is to be of service to another person or to be helpful. Now, those two things sound so wonderful, so angelic. Follow your heart and be of service. But often those two ideas can lead you in utterly, you know, diametrically opposing directions in life. Sometimes what we really want to do is not of great service. Or what's the most service we want to do, could do, is not really following our heart. So, in each situation, rather than fill you up with a bunch of slogans, which are abstract, it's better to give you tools so that you can apply to see what's going on in your experience and learn for yourselves what's working, what's not, what actions you want to pursue, what actions you feel are leading you to a dead end. The key, of course, is that for you to sustain the practice for a little while. The problem we get in life is when we only look for short-term solutions. Drugs are wonderful short-term solutions. They work really, really well in the short term. All of your problems will go away in the short term. Alcohol, having sex with as many people as fast as you possibly can. All these things will feel great in the short term. In the long term, though, they're going to have quite a different play on your self-esteem, your inner state of peace, the amount of agitation in your life, the amount of drama, the amount of the serenity you're capable of. So we want to see not just the short term, but how things play out in the long term. So that's the first thing to bear in mind. It's not just how do each action play out immediately, but also how does it play out the next day, the days following. And according to that also, it's best to try out life one thing at a time. In our hectic trying to deal with everything all at once and throw as many things at problems as we possibly can, it's very difficult to see what's working and what's not. So some of the ground rules. Number one, finding peace of mind is an inside job. No matter what someone has said to you or done, so long as if they're dangerous, you've gotten out of a dangerous situation, or if it's tolerable, you've decided to tolerate it. But most of the work is going to be working with the way we react rather than trying to change the people or the situations around us. For example, I put the the talks up on the podcast site, and they keep on raising the money that it costs. And my friend and I keep paying more and more. And I keep sending these nice notes saying, hey, we're a nonprofit. I'm really not making any money from anything. I haven't made a penny. And, you know, could you see to, you know, just cutting us some slack? Because a lot of people are downloading the talks. And they said, no, we don't care. So I, you know, for the first moment there was, meh. But then I realized, you know what, that they're not suffering. They've made their point of view very clear. And if I repeat and just, you know, replay the whole thing and get into a how dare they and a self-justified rant of resentment, the only thing that's going to happen is I'm going to just experience mental agitation. It's not going to, in any way, though I wish I was that powerful, it's not in any way going to affect them. So I have to look in, find out where my sense of resentment is, and I have to work with that to release it. Trying to get a podcast host service to do what I want is an utterly waste of time, as is almost any endeavor where I'm trying to change anyone or anything. My ability to control anything outside of me is extremely limited. So it's an inside job. But then the second rule that's, or second tool that's worth considering is that when we focus our awareness inside, every thought and every action matters. Everything we do has a result. Now, it may seem like if the world's falling around us and people are all upset about something and there's a lot of drama in our lives, and we take time to go and settle and breathe and relax and see how the drama is invading our inner experience, that may seem like, well, what the fuck am I doing? Like, everything's all a mess out there, and I'm just sitting here becoming aware of the stress in me and where I can, calmly working with the breath and the body to release it. That might seem like it's sort of beside the point. But actually, it has profound effects in the way that the mind reacts to drama. There's a lot of wonderful science that shows that when people practice this for as short as a month, they begin to rewire the brain so they are less fearful, less impulsive, less driven by this overwhelming feeling of the world's going to fall apart. And wouldn't you rather make decisions from a place of calmness than from a place of fear in your life? Neuroscientists tell us that every time we fire neurons, we wire them together. If during a difficult experience in life, we bring our awareness within and we work on calming ourselves, we are literally wiring that not only as a process into the mind, but we're also rewiring that to the striatum, which is where all our habitual responses are stored. So literally, the chances become greater that the next time we're faced with an upheaval in our friends or the situations around us, rather than reacting or feeling we need to act immediately or getting pushed around or doing something in the spur of the moment that we later regret, will actually increase the likelihood that that part of the brain, the, okay, let's calm down, let's relax first, let's release the stress so that I'm not making my decisions from a driven place. And when I'm not driven, when I'm not physically uncomfortable, I begin to have more choices available to me. If I'm physically uncomfortable and there's stress going around me in a workplace or in a family situation or with friends, if I'm physically uncomfortable, I'm not going to have the mental bandwidth to consider options. I'm going to go for the most immediate short-term solution. But if I'm physically comfortable, I will be able to take time and say, wait, is there another way, another approach? So all of our actions matter. All of our thoughts matter. They all not only plant a sense of ease right now, but they have ramifications into the future of the way our minds will respond to stress and difficulty in life. The third is start with the body. Start with the body. Now, it sounds like a strange thing when we're faced with dramas and faced with problems that we feel we have to solve and fears that are overriding and concerns and goals that need addressing. The idea of refocusing again and again to how is this playing out in my breath? How does my breath feel right now? How does my body feel? How does my stomach? Is my stomach tight? Is my chest contracted? Is my shoulders tight? Is my jaw locked? Is my forehead scrunched? Is my teeth grinding? Are my teeth, not is my teeth. Are my jaws, yes. Should have figured out the verb conjugation before I started that one. But we want to do this for a couple of reasons. First of all, A, when we're in fear, the thoughts are what's known as sticky, compelling. If you try to battle your fear head on, you're not going to succeed. Why? Because while you're battling the thoughts or trying to reason with the fear, try to reason with the anger, you're physically tense too. So you don't have all of the capacity or all of the ingenuity, all of the resources available to you. You're already under stress. And trying to go head on against your fear, which has already been planted in your brain since you were born, the amygdala has been fired up and working. It's got a lot of experience. It's a good enemy in that courtroom in your mind. It's a good lawyer you're up against. And I guarantee with fear, even if you come up with a winning argument, it will appeal the verdict the next moment. So rather than go head on against our fear or anger or concern or confusion, we dismantle it wherever possible in the body, in the breath, in the feelings, in the emotional states, so that when we do go up to visit upon the thoughts that comprise them, we won't be pushed, we won't be constrained, we won't be in this tight little uncomfortable shell, and we will also be in a much more relaxed experience. We will be not in this feeling of everything's going to fall apart, because we will have dealt with the body. And by that point, we've put down the fear thoughts for long enough that when they come up, they won't have caught us off guard, which fear often does. This time we'll be prepared. The fourth tool is to focus the mind on the elements in our experience that are changing. When we're ever in difficult times, when we're in emotional states, when we're feeling we're overwhelmed by life, or we're in experience, it could be chronic pain or chronic unemployment or chronic romantic disappointment or chronic problems with our families, when we feel stuck, it's because we're looking at everything globally. But if we focus in and look inwardly and find, locate what's changing in each experience, then states no longer feel like a given. For example, suppose I feel lonely for a couple of days, disconnected from people. Then what I do is, instead of just say, okay, I'm in loneliness, I am lonely, I turn it into a state of who I am a lonely person, or whatever. Instead of doing this whole globalizing identity statement, I go in and I say, okay, there's a feeling of loneliness. What is it comprised of? Well, there's a hollowness in the chest. There's a sense of absence in the mind. There's a yearning for connection. And if I focus in on any one of these elements, I'll notice that on a day-by-day moment, actually on a moment-by-moment basis, they're all changing. The hollowness of loneliness in the chest, if I sit with it rather than all the thoughts and all that, I'll see, oh wow, the way loneliness feels inside of me is not always the same. There's a difference in loneliness today than yesterday's loneliness. Or if I focus in on what exactly, how are the thoughts talking? Are they yelling? Are they being very soothing? Are they just saying, throw out the towel? Or are they saying, what kind of voice is loneliness presenting itself to me? I can examine it, the voice from the outside. Any element I stay with long enough, I'll see is not static. It's in fact changing. And the moment I begin to perceive the change that's going on in my life, then I no longer feel stuck or condemned. Then I'm no longer coming at loneliness from a place that is, I am loneliness, that's who I am, I can't get out of it. I've already located the fact that loneliness is comprised of different sensations, different emotional states, different thoughts, and all of these things are changing. Even if they're only changing gradually, they are changing. And then I can figure out which elements I can work with. Or I can, as I work with connecting with new people in my life, I can see, okay, how does this play out now in the body, emotionally, in the realm of thoughts? A fifth, and for me the most important of the tools to develop insight, is that no matter what I'm going through in life, it's important to me to reflect that the core experience is never unique. I have never had in my life a unique emotion, nor have you. We all want to believe that our feelings and our emotions and the way that our emotional states are playing out are unique or different. But actually, the mind is only capable of a very limited emotional set. Paul Elman actually limited, I think, to basically 8 or 9 core emotions that are transcultural in every culture. Now, the details in our life, sure, they're all different. I'm going through what I'm going through, you're going through what you're going through, and not only are the details different, the external details, but the little stories we tell about ourselves, they're fascinatingly different. Our memoirs are all unique. We've all got a memoir waiting to be written that's so special. But, and that's fine. As a great monk, Ajahn Chah, once said, we're all the same, but we're all different, but we're all the same. What he meant by that is that we all have the same core emotional reactions to life. But all of our situations, our details, the external stuff is all different, but the solutions are always the same. So rather than get caught up in fixating on what's different or what feels unique, well, my boss is a real shit. My roommate is really, really obstinate. My girlfriend or boyfriend really, really, really is difficult. My parents are really, really challenging. Instead, remember that core experience of frustration, rejection, loneliness, you know, confusion, everybody has those experiences. So we don't have to feel alone. And we don't have to approach life like we are experiencing anything that's about us. Loss, rejection, aging, sickness, disappointment. The Buddha said these are the fundamental noble truths that everybody experiences. And we all have the same reactions as well. We all have confusion, doubt, disappointment, anger. Or Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said we had anger, denial, bargaining, acceptance. There was a fifth one. What? Depression. So we have, either way you do it, you cut the cake. There's only a few alternative responses to life. And whatever we're going through, if we reflect, wow, the core emotional state I'm going through, it's not unique. There are people out there who will understand. The thing that trips us up is when we go to people and we get lost telling them the details, the external details. I'm in this situation where my boss wanted me to come in on Thursday, but I had already told them on Thursday I was not going to come in, but they said they had to be there. The other person's like... But if we say to another human being, I'm feeling frustrated because I'm feeling that I'm not being understood, they'll understand, I guarantee you. So if we focus on the core emotional responses rather than get lost in the details of the whole history of our lives and how our father was distant and high school was challenging and my all this, just go to what's real, what's true. So those are the five tools that hopefully will be of use to you. Again, finding happiness is an inside job. Everything we do when we react is important, will play out in the future. There are no lost gestures. Focus in on the body first before we argue or try to work with thoughts that are obsessive. Focus in on what's changing rather than experiencing any emotional state as something inherent to us, or I am this or I am that. Go for what's changing, and finally assume that every emotional state that we're going through in life is not unique. Assume that we're part of the human fabric. We were all born into human bodies with human brains. We all have the same human responses. So thank you for listening. Hope you got something out of it. And now I